Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 98 on Friday, June 4, 2010. I'm back in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where my interview guest is based, but he was out of town on June 1st when we did the interview, so we did it by Skype as usual. James McQuivey will explain why he was disappointed in Jeff Bezos' remarks at the Amazon annual meeting, and we talked about lots of other things too. It's always great to have him on the show. In news, a number of items. Bloomberg Report is quoting anonymous sources at Amazon, and there were other sort of ancillary rumors reported in other places, but it looks pretty clear that there's going to be a new Kindle out in August, and the Bloomberg report talked about a thinner, sharper, faster unit, and I'm not sure where the code name came from, but someone was reporting that the code name for the new Kindle, which we'd probably call the Kindle 3, is Shasta. Also, Amazon missed its target date for wirelessly updating the Kindle software to version 2.5 by late May, but hold on, you should be getting the new release soon. Consumer Reports, I just noticed today, gives Kindle the edge over the iPad for reading books in a comparison that, as I said, just came out a few moments ago is when I saw it. Tomorrow, June 5th, is the day you can stop by your local Target store and buy a Kindle. And from Stephen Windwalker in the New York Times, Times' new publishing beat reporter, I will have the latest indications that this ebook thing is not going to blow over soon. The tech tip, courtesy of Bufo Calvin, will give you some tips in the unfortunate circumstance of losing your Kindle. In content, I'm going to point you to a favorite source of recommendations for Kindle books that I haven't mentioned for a while. With that, let's turn to the news. Item one in the news is this Bloomberg report that there's going to be a new Kindle in August and that it's going to be thinner than the existing Kindle 2. It's described as having a sharper font, so higher readability than the current Kindle, and also faster page turns. Some of the other reports that were coming out at the same time as this Bloomberg story said that the Kindle that comes out in August might have Wi-Fi only, and as we talked about in the interview with James McQuivey, that would be something that might help keep the cost down. The reports of this new Kindle didn't mention price, but in my own thinking about it, I'm very hopeful that if there's a new unit which is aiming straight at ebook reading, then it's going to be more down at the Kobo price point of $150, maybe even less. So August is coming. I have a birthday in August, so that, in addition to my duty to you listeners to stay in touch with us, I'll certainly be doing everything I can to get one early so that I can tell you everything I know about it, and we'll have a lot of fun seeing what Amazon comes out with in such a competitive environment, given the advent of the iPad and then also some of the other competitors. Item two, Amazon, when they first announced version 2.5 of the software, said that they hoped to get it out to everybody by late May. They missed that deadline. I saw in an item I read in Andras Baston's blog, kindleworld.blogspot.com, that in the forums there was somebody quoting an Amazon tech support person as saying that the new rollout to everyone should be coming very soon. And so hopefully, perhaps by the time you hear this, if you check your settings on your Kindle 2 or DX, you're going to see version 2.5, and then you'll be able to experiment with all the new features that we've been talking about in past shows. Item three, Consumer Reports did an interesting comparison of the Kindle versus the iPad, and there's a video that goes with it. I'll have a link in the show notes where one of their guys sort of defends the iPad and the other one defends the Kindle. In the write-up, they seem to give the advantage to the Kindle, citing the things that we all know about, the huge advantage in price, and then other features which make it more suitable for long-form reading, which is what Jeff Bezos and others at Amazon are always stressing, is that this is the best way to read books. There was an associated report which said that they had also compared it to the Nook. In the main article, which I just read, I just saw the comparison with the iPad, but apparently in taking a look at the Nook and a couple of other e-ink readers, Consumer Reports again gave the advantage to the Kindle. Now, they included the Sony Reader Touch and I believe the Daily Edition, one of the other Sony readers, and said that the Kindle came out on top. They didn't mention the Kobo, which I think is, you know, really needs to be in any kind of a comparison of the e-ink readers these days. And they didn't mention the Sony Pocket Edition, which is one which I bought this week, because I thought as I was comparing the Kobo to the other two major e-ink readers, the Nook and the Kindle, that it really would be fair to have a Sony reader in the mix there too. And it was not as inexpensive as the Kobo. I think it was under $200. I bought a little case for it, and I haven't really had a chance to play around with it much, but it's a very, you can really put it in the pocket of a sport coat, and it's got that nice lightness that the Kobo has. So it's definitely in sort of the same category of e-ink reader. Tomorrow, June 5th, is the day that the Kindle should be at the Target stores. There's a Target in Watertown at the Arsenal Mall. I think I'll stroll over there and see what kind of a display they have up at Target and what kind of action is being generated from people checking it out. Reports from the early pilot of Kindles in Target stores in Minnesota and then some stores in Florida, there was one report that said that they were selling like crazy, so that the rollout is something which perhaps is going to give another good boost to Kindle sales. And it'll be the first time, of course, that you can actually go to a store somewhere and get your hands on a Kindle. And I hope they've got the Target people trained so that you can actually go and try it out, and that there'll be somebody that can answer a few questions. To help the movement, we all should go to a Target store and stand around and answer a few questions, because there's going to be a lot of questions asked in that setting, and quite a challenge to come up with in-store people who will be able to be very helpful. And final item in news, a couple of data points actually showing the growth in the share of the total book market of ebooks. First comes from Stephen Windwalker's Kindle Nation daily blog, and he reports the publisher's marketplace information that says that first week ebook sales for Stieg Larsson's instant bestseller, The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, amounted to nearly 30% of all units sold. And this is a popular subscription-based book industry, and their website is reporting that Knopf Doubleday spokesman Paul Bogard said their internal figures showed an approximate first week sell-through of 425,000 units, which includes 125,000 ebook editions. Steve fired up his calculator and found that translates to 29.4% ebook share of the total sell-through. And he points out he was the one that was all over the story on how Dan Brown's The Lost Symbol last year was at one point seemed to be selling more ebook units than hardcover at the Kindle store, and that the total sell-through for The Lost Symbol last year put it at less than 10% of the title's overall sales. So that's a pretty big jump from 10% less than a year ago to 29% in the first week for this particular book. The other data point that I came across this week was in the excellent New York Times Book Review podcast hosted by Sam Tannenhaus. And since Julie Bosman is the new person on the book beat for the Times, she shows up on the podcast, and she reported in the episode dated May 28th on her first trip to the Book Expo America in New York. This is how she described the scene for Sam.
It was, you know, a lot of booksellers grabbing up free galleys, authors on panels, and publishers trying to decide how nervous they should be about ebooks.
They're kind of getting bigger and bigger, right? You report in your story, they're taking over, I mean, what's now not enormous, but consequential size of the market of actual book sales. Is that right?
That's right. I think last year at this time, it was about 3% of the total trade books market. This year, some of the major publishers, even though they don't release their sales figures publicly, they said privately that it's about 8 to 10% based on their first quarter of this year. So it is small but growing, and there's a lot of debate over how quickly it will grow and how big it will be.
Another good podcast that was taped actually at the Book Expo America was Guy LaCharles Gonzalez's show, which he hosts with a number of people from the book industry. And they were commenting on comments that had been made by Garrison Keillor and other CEOs of publishers. And the theme that I picked up from that was that people at that level tend to make sweeping generalizations about ebooks and what's happening. And meanwhile, off in the corners, you've got people like Open Road, which is one of the panelists, is from there. He's a guy I talked to when I was out at South by Southwest, Pablo Difendini. And they're just doing the work. They're out there making deals and getting backlists into ebook form. And I think Open Road was the one that did the deal with William Styron's estate. So you've got the ebook sector unfolding and much in evidence on the ground at something like BEA, it sounds like. And then you've got the people in the big panels and the plenary sessions pontificating about what it means and where it's going. For the tech tip, I'm going to refer you to a post by Bufo Calvin at his I Love My Kindle blog. That's ilmk.wordpress.com. Bufo, unfortunately, had a Kindle slip away from his control, and he's not really, it's a big mystery as to where it went. And this post, I'm not sure if it predates him actually losing that Kindle or not, but it's a really good rundown of what to do in that situation. The main thing is unless you left it at a friend's house or a relative's house and you know that it's not in danger of being used by a stranger, the first thing you want to do is deregister the device. And you can do that at the Kindle, at your Kindle page under Manage Your Kindle. Because, of course, if you don't deregister it and someone picks up your Kindle and they know their way around a Kindle, they can access your account, they can buy books. If you've got email passwords in there, they could even get into your email, so there could be all kinds of trouble. Bufo recommends completing a police report saying, although a Kindle is likely to be considered petty theft, the typical cutoff is $400. The police may be able to recover it, and having a police report may help with other steps. You can also contact Amazon and ask them to blacklist or deactivate the device, and that will prevent it from being re-registered by someone else. This is something that Bufo was able to confirm on May 24th with Kindle customer service. This is after his own Kindle had been missing for 7 weeks. You can call to do this at 866-321-8851. International customers call 206-266-0927. This is a long post, and it's really valuable. He talks about a service that can reportedly give you an 85% chance of getting back your Kindle, and it's at trackitback.com, and I'll have a link to that, and you can read Bufo's description of it. He ends up thinking it probably is worth the $12.95, especially if you keep valuable personal documents on your Kindle. I've always lately am thinking of Bufo when I make sure that I check the airline seat and make sure I've put my Kindle back in the bag, and it would really be a devastating thing to leave it somewhere and then just never find it. And if you find a Kindle out there, I don't know if there's any identifying marks on it for Bufo's, but I sure hope he gets it back. James McQuivey is Vice President and Principal Analyst at Forrester Research, where he covers media technology. I've turned to him several times in the past to help understand moves made by Amazon, Apple, Google, and others. So in the wake of last week's Amazon annual meeting and rumors of a new Kindle coming in August, I wanted to check in with him again. We spoke by Skype on June 1st. I want to mention at the outset that you are going to hear a mysterious noise as we get into the interview, particularly toward the latter part of it. And it's always an issue when I'm doing an interview by Skype. If there's a noise that looks like it might detract from the listening experience, I have to decide, am I going to break the conversation here and address the noise. In the case of this conversation with James, he was bringing up so many things which I found fascinating. I delayed even asking about it, but I eventually will get around, as you listen to this, to find out what that mysterious noise is. By the end of the interview, you are going to know what it is as well. I began by asking James for his reaction to the few tidbits about the Kindle that Amazon founder and CEO Jeff Bezos let drop in his prepared remarks and answers to a few questions from stockholders.
Well, I was a little disappointed that he wasn't in a position to make any stronger hints about a competitor to the iPad. And I don't know if he's just trying to keep expectations realistic or if he is really genuinely not interested in competing with the iPad. As you know, I've been a big believer that Amazon can and will compete head-to-head with the iPad while still maintaining the existing standalone Kindle business. And the comments from Bezos so far suggest that that's not what he's looking at right now.
Do you think there's any chance that this is like when Steve Jobs said no one reads anymore, so why would anybody worry about ebooks?
In which way? I'm sorry, I don't follow you.
Well, that Bezos, if he's got an iPad killer up his sleeve, he's sort of throwing everybody off the track by saying we're just going to stick to long-form reading. And at one point I noticed he seemed to be raising the bar higher or lowering it, however you look at it, that the Kindle is great if you're reading something for 3 hours at a stretch or more.
right, which is, he certainly doesn't want to make that the benchmark for when you decide to get a Kindle, as if you're going to regularly read it 3 hours at a stretch or more.
I suppose the people that do read for 3 hours at a stretch are still probably buying a pretty big slice of books.
Well, and the Kindle. I mean, that's the thing. The thing about the Kindle business is that it is extremely attractive to long-form readers. Yeah. And, you know, that's a good fourth of the population, and not all of them have an e-reader yet, and they still won't by the end of this year. So there is a lot of room left in that audience. However, the long-term ability to shape and influence even long-form reading will rest in the hands of whoever makes a device that encompasses more of our personal media than just this one particular one. So it would just be completely wrong-headed for Amazon to decide to serve long-form readers only to the exclusion of the other devices, because those other devices will eventually be better to serve long-form readers.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. If you look at it now and you say, well, you know, you hold an iPad in your hands, it takes two hands to hold it for very long, and you can't really read it in as many positions for as long a time, well, that's fine when you're comparing today's iPad to today's Kindle. But tomorrow's iPad and tomorrow's Kindle better look a whole lot more like each other than they do today, or somebody's not getting the point.
Yeah. How much stock do you put in the Bloomberg report saying that in August we're going to see the next Kindle as thinner and sharper image and quicker on the page refresh?
Well, I do actually believe that that's a likely direction for Amazon to go as well. I've maintained that Amazon should really pursue a dual-prong strategy, with the one prong headed straight for Apple and the iPad, but the other prong taking advantage of the fact that it does serve long-form readers and essentially racing to the bottom in the price war, which is going to be $99 by the beginning of next year, if not the end of this year, where you're going to see e-ink-based e-readers in the $99 range, which are very optimized for long-form reading, not interactive, probably not even 3G. That's a detail in the Bloomberg report that I'm waiting to see if it turns out to be true or not. I believe it won't be 3G. It'll just be Wi-Fi.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's the ideal place for Amazon to corner that part of the market, to say, look, even if you own an iPad, you can't read on it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you might not even want to take it with you when you go to the beach, certainly not. So let's give you a $99 Kindle, and we'll sell you a $29 insurance plan for it that you can take to the beach. And if you spill it or spill water on it or break it or it gets washed away in the surf, you get a new one as part of the insurance upgrade, and you don't lose anything because all of your data is synchronized with the cloud over Wi-Fi. And I think that's an end of the market that Amazon can completely own, while meanwhile they stay in the upper realm targeting the iPad with a different kind of device.
So, and the dropping of the 3G, the main purpose of that would be as a way to get to that lower price point?
it gets to the lower price point, and it actually acknowledges what we know about these users, which is a lot of these people are not doing a lot of 3G book buying. That a lot of these Kindles, and especially the Sony devices, because they're not wireless, we're finding they're just being used in the home as a very convenient way to read in the home mostly, and occasionally at a soccer game or some other locale where you might otherwise carry a paperback book with you. Well, you don't need the connectivity remotely to read that content as long as you can synchronize over Wi-Fi in the home. So let's get the price lower by not putting in the 3G, because it saves on not only the service fee, the carriage cost from the network, but also obviously the radio that you got to put in the device in the first place. So I think that's how we get to $99. But I think that might also explain why Amazon appears not to be putting touch into this device, although in the long run, that's also a mistake. In the long run, all of these devices are going to have touch on them.
Yeah, I am finding, because I'm using the Nook a fair amount, and I was also using the Alex, and that touch controller screen on the Nook, I find much more appealing than the buttons on the Kindle.
Absolutely. What's happening is that the world is moving to touch independent of e-readers. And it is obviously the iPhone's fault. The iPhone taught everyone to appreciate touch. And so now we have touch on so many more phones from HTC and from other makers who are trying to benefit from the iPhone. But as a result, what happens is people just think things are touchable. You know, we're getting into that environment where people are going to start thinking they can touch their TV screens just out of habit. And I think that's going to happen to readers. You're going to have people touching their reader screens on accident, even though they know that it doesn't have touch built in. And if you've played with the Sony Daily Edition or the Sony Touch, you know how powerful that is to have that touchability. Although it adds cost and it does dim the screen. And those are both negatives. And if you're trying to corner the lower end of the market, then it makes sense to leave touch off for now. But eventually, all of these devices have touch.
Well, and in the question that Bezos had at the meeting that he seemed sort of most purposefully to duck was the one about the acquisition of the touchscreen company. What does that make you think?
No comment means something's coming. Yeah. It has to. There's no reason to make that acquisition if you don't think you're going to significantly enhance your devices in the future. Now, the question is it going to grace both form factors, the iPad competitor and the low-end Kindle? Is it going to be focused on one of them in the short run and both of them in the long run? That's all legitimate. And frankly, let's be honest, Amazon hasn't had a lot of time to respond to the iPad. So any device that they could theoretically release by August is a device they already had the chipset built for 6 months ago at the end of 2009. So it's not something where we could really look at an August deployment as a device that really is a response to iPad, because it had to be designed before the iPad even came out.
You know, and those other reports that are coming out of Lab 126 about hiring people that are doing more than just working on a dedicated reader, it sounds like, it does make you think maybe there's a two-pronged strategy, and the Kindle iPad killer shows up in time for the Christmas season, but they fire this one off for the dedicated reader group first.
Yeah, solidify your base. It's a little bit like military strategy. You secure your base, and then you go after the new battleground. And that's what they should do. I don't know that they'll be able to get an iPad competitor out in time for the holidays, though. And as I read Bezos's comments, I see in them a very gentle nudge or warning to the market that we might not expect something in time for December, or that if we do, and here's the rub, do they announce something in December, even though it's only going to be deployed in Q1 of 2011, and thereby actually suck a huge portion of Kindle sales out of the market right in time for the holidays?
Oh, yeah.
It's a double-edged sword. You could announce, hey, in December, guys, we are competing. We're ready to compete. We're going to have our iPad competitor out just in 3 months. And then you lose a lot of demand for your current product while people decide to wait. Or on the other hand, you just let a whole bunch of people buy your Kindle in Q4. And then in January, you announce that in March, you've got a new device and everyone gets mad that you didn't warn them. Yeah. So there's really no way to play that one perfectly. And I think Bezos is maybe hinting to us that he's going to wait until January to announce the competitor.
2 months into the iPad era, we've got 2 million units sold. Have you guys at Forrester increased your estimated sales for 2010, or does it still look on track even though it's off to such a strong start?
Well, remember, we're now talking global numbers. and the global numbers, if you look at how many countries they went with, I think we're in 9 foreign countries now with the iPad. Even if they only sold 100,000 in each market, that can account for 1 million. So we're not confident that the 2 million number really means that U.S. sales have suddenly kicked in at a higher level than they were already. And we're only forecasting U.S. So our number was originally 2 million to 3 million right when it was first announced. After we saw, in the U.S., I should say, mm-hmm. After the first weekend, we said, well, we're going to stick with the high end of our forecast, which puts us around 3 million in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And frankly, we didn't have a firm number for international because we don't know, at the time, we didn't know what countries or on what timetable. And of course, the timetable changed and the countries have shifted around a little bit. But we're looking right now and saying we still think the 3 million is a good, but it's now the low end of mm-hmm. the range. It's probably 3 to 3.5 mm-hmm. in the U.S. Mm-hmm. What we don't know is it going to match that globally? Which if it does, that would be a pretty considerable feat. And it would definitely give us reason to think that Apple is going to be manufacturing at such a scale that they could really, really push this in 2011. So we kind of have to watch because the global scale benefits even the U.S. market because at that point they have more flexibility with the pricing. They can start looking at version 2.0, which we assume they'll make some tweaks to for 2011 and make features that are even more attractive, and therefore the 2011 numbers have to go up. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's a dicey game, but we still think that in the U.S. we're looking at 3 to 3.5 million this year.
What do you make of the Kobo? It seems like that's off to a pretty strong start. It's a neat little device. It's so small. Is that possibly going to jump up into the second place ahead of the Sony Reader line?
I got to say, Sony is a pretty firmly entrenched number two. Mm-hmm. Both the Nook and the Kobo, as fun as they are on different levels in very different directions, they have a long way to go. Remember, Sony was in this market a full year before Amazon was. It doesn't mean that they were in a position to lead it by any means because it was Amazon's content expertise that really allowed it to make this a market, and Sony has just drafted along after them very effectively, I might add. And so what I look at is who's number three, and is there room for a number four? Mm. Not that there aren't going to be a dozen devices because there kind of already are, but in the end, you probably only need three major players. Nook has a certain advantage because their distribution in the U.S. Through Barnes & Noble and the partners that Barnes & Noble is able to align with gives them a little bit of an advantage over Kobo, just purely from channel strategy. Mm-hmm. But Kobo is getting a lot of great attention because the device is focused and honed on the reader as an individual, and that's always a good place to be. So I think they will make a splash. It could make this a four-player game over the next 2 years. When I say four-player, I mean among the e-ink devices. But in the long run, we probably don't need that many, at least not in a world where they're using different formats. Let's go to an analogous business, for example. In the world of televisions, there really are four major manufacturers of televisions, and then there's another four or five who are also in the market, and then another four or five who have a tiny impact. And you can kind of look at the e-reader business as having a similar flow. There might be four really big ones, including the iPad, and then there'd be four that kind of eke along the margins, making incremental improvements and building loyalty among their likely niche. And then there's always a handful of people who are making new devices on the margins, but not really having any significant impact. It could end up becoming that kind of business. In the long run, we just have to see how quickly it merges with the tablet business, which is another disruption that's likely to mess things up and reshuffle that whole thing. Mm.
I think it's going to be okay on the audio, but I have to ask, what's that banging going on?
Oh, you can hear that? I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I'm in my home office, and I'm hearing
the patter of little feet?
Yeah, well, not so little, evidently. I don't know if they're playing tag or what.
That's all right. I'm going to keep it in. This is something you get in a podcast that you don't get to hear on NPR. Okay, well, last question I want to talk to you about is magazines and newspapers. The Barnes & Noble app that hit the iPad, you're supposed to be able to get newspapers, although there were some glitches when I tried to download some single copies of the Globe and the Washington Post. But how come the Kindle subscriptions aren't able to come over to the iPad and some of the other platforms. And is that sort of a significant drawback in Amazon's strategy or ability to compete?
You know, it's a fair question. One of the issues is that Amazon has built its an entirely separate desktop publishing system for its for the content that's deployed to the Kindle. And as a result, it's completely disconnected from even the internal publishing systems that magazine publishers and newspaper publishers are using. And it's a little bit of a long run. That's going to be some friction because people are going to be developing an app for the iPhone or for the iPad. And then they have to do a separate app for the Android and then a separate app for the Kindle. And if you're a magazine provider and you're publishing full color glossies with interactive advertising, well, that just doesn't translate particularly well to today's Kindle. And so you're probably going to rank the Kindle development among the lowest priorities of your development strategy. And I think that's going to be a challenge for Kindle in the long run. And it's part of a price they pay for being first in this business is they weren't first enough to force everybody to adopt their particular publishing strategy or technology, and particularly because their devices don't serve magazine and newspaper publishers particularly well. So, that's going to make a problem. And I've even talked to newspaper publishers who are saying, well, we're developing our app for the iPad right now. But the thing is, we'd really like to sell someone a buy once, read on any mobile device kind of experience. We don't want to sell you a separate iPad app from a separate Kindle experience, but right now we have to. And we're worried our audience will think we're nickel and diming them. And I think that's a valid worry. And I think in the end, it probably means that Amazon suffers a little bit as developers just push it to the back of their development plans.
Yeah, your piece, I think about a month ago, you were talking about how the publishers are not happy to get crowded out of the flash use, but the advantages in the walled garden that Apple's creating, there could be chances to charge more than they could otherwise.
Yeah, they might actually get people to pay for that content because they can't really get it any other way.
Yeah.
And I think people are secretly happy about that. But I will say this, more and more of the magazine publishers and newspaper publishers I'm talking to, once they get over their initial excitement about being able to serve iPad users, they do start to worry. They worry about being married to an Apple world. And they do worry that it means they're developing twice, once for Apple and then once for everybody else. And that's just not a long-term sustainable model. And so many of them are secretly cheering Android on.
Yeah.
Because they're hoping, look, if we get more Android phones in the world than we have iPhones and iPads, then maybe Apple will be a little more humble to approach. And that's something that they can hope for, at least. Whether it happens or not is another issue.
Everybody's always hoping for the next player to beat the current champ.
Right. And then when the next player ascends, they get really nervous about that.
That's right. Everybody loves the underdog. Well, have you resisted the hype and still managed not to buy an iPad?
I have so far, although there are days where I really, really question myself on that one. What I'm really hoping for is that somebody comes out with a tablet that does intrigue me and does make me want to get it first, and then I can come to the iPad on version 2. But, you know, with HP deciding to postpone the slate in order probably to incorporate the Palm OS, it's not giving me a lot to choose from. And so far, the things we're hearing from Dell's camp are suggesting that that Dell isn't necessarily giving me my ideal device yet either. So I'll just have to wait and see. And if I break down by the end of summer, I will have to eat that crow.
Well, meanwhile, I admire your discipline. That's great. Well, good talking to you, James. I'll be getting back to you to confirm your status as a seer if sort of a stealth iPad killer does end up coming out of Seattle. That would be kind of a fun little drama to see, but we'll just have to see.
Well, look, let's be fair. Amazon, the people at Amazon have a business to run that I don't necessarily have to consider all of the implications of my suggestions when I'm making my prognostications. But if I were in their shoes, I would be marshaling all my resources to head straight after the iPad because this is a once-in-a-lifetime shot. And if they miss it, I'm afraid they don't recover.
We'll leave James on that somewhat ominous note and look forward to staying in touch with him for more insights as the year unfolds. You can follow James. He has a blog that is at the Forrester site. If you go to blogs.forrester, that's three R's in Forrester, Forrester.com/James_McQuivey. And McQuivey is McQuivey. His latest post yesterday, June 3rd, includes a video of him talking about how media companies can get people to pay for content. Turning now to content for the Kindle, I want to spend a little time at a blog that I've mentioned in the past, and I actually did an interview with the creator of the blog, Jan Zlendich, in one of the early episodes of the podcast. It is the Kindle Reader, and you can find it at kindlereader.blogspot.com if you're not familiar with it, perhaps you're new to the show. Jan is a librarian by training in her career, worked at a big university library system. So her way of dealing with things that you might find interesting to read on the Kindle has kind of a librarian's eye and finesse to it. I just find it really intriguing the way she sets things up. As an example, for Thursday, June 3rd, she has a post titled Kindle Genre Watch, New in Fantasy and Mystery Fiction. She begins it by saying, genre fiction as opposed to nonfiction, graphic novels, and picture books lends itself to enjoyable Kindle reading because when you pick up a book of fiction, you don't necessarily expect it to be illustrated. Authors of mysteries, science fiction, fantasy, romance novels, and westerns paint word pictures, and their readers use their own imagination to picture the scene of the crime or the stare of a vampire or the track of an alien spacecraft hurtling towards Earth. And so then what she does in this post, she splits it up some titles in the fantasy category, including Soul Catcher by Lee Bridger. Magic Bites is that's the where that series began by Bridger. She also mentions Dead in the Family, a Sookie Stackhouse novel by Charlaine Harris. Magic Bleeds by Ilona Andrews. And then on down. Then there's another section titled Mystery. That includes The Burning Wire by Jeffrey Deaver, book 9 in the Lincoln Rhymes series. I've read some Deaver books. I thought they're pretty good. The Nearest Exit by Olin Steinhauer. Now, and then she's creative in the way she sets up her recommendations. On Tuesday, June 1, there's an item that says books they're talking about, Kindle books in the media. And she's found authors that are scheduled to be on TV, and then she gives you the links to their books, and you can go and get them on your Kindle and then be ready to see, for example, well, it's past now, but on ABC's Good Morning America, Rita Cosby, the author of Quiet Hero, Secrets from My Father's Past, she was going to be doing an interview on Good Morning America. Jan gives a description of her approach. If you scroll down on the right, she discloses that she's an Amazon affiliate, as we all are that are mining the Kindle sphere and spending a lot of time. And then she says, the Kindle Reader, her blog, chooses the ebooks listed here based on years of experience as a librarian in university and public libraries, on her personal interests, and on the opinions of the Amazon Kindle community. The Kindle Reader is not a book review site. It is designed to be a time-saving menu of reading choices. As in a library setting, I suggest books that might interest you, and you decide whether you will enjoy reading them. I went scrolling back in the archives of her blog, and her first post was on November 30th, 2007, which was precisely 11 days after the launch of the first Kindle. So she has been at this a long time, and she, she's a very disciplined and regular contributor to her blog. She also, it says here, I'm not sure how new this is, but you can subscribe to her blog. It's in the Kindle subscription service. So if you want to read her blog on the Kindle, it'll show up right on your Kindle. I'm not sure, some blogs like that, when they've got links to books that you can buy, I don't think they'll take you there, because the way the Kindle interfaces with the Kindle store, but it's pretty easy to be reading along in her blog or other blogs. Stephen Wynn Walker, Anders Bast, and others have lots of good tips on things to read. You just spot the book and type it into your Kindle, and then slide the five-way over to search the Kindle store, and you'll have the book in less than a minute. So it's pretty easy. So that's my content suggestion today. If you're not familiar with Jans Lendich's The Kindle Reader blog, I would highly recommend that you check it out. Time now for your comments. I want to begin by apologizing. Apparently a glitch crept into my show notes page, and when people were trying to leave comments there, which is a great way to leave comments on each episode, they were being turned back, and I wasn't getting emails saying, you know, here's a comment that needs to be moderated. So luckily I heard from a listener, actually several listeners, but the first one I think that told me about it was Tony Roberts, said, he wrote me, recently discovered your podcast and I'm enjoying it very much. We have a few differences of opinion, which I may relate to you in further messages at a later time. I wrote to him, I said, I would really like to hear those differences of opinion sooner rather than later. So I hope Tony will follow up and tell me some of the things that he's hearing on the show that he disagrees with. That would make for some lively content. For now, he says, you have two links on your blog roll that need to be deleted. Oh, okay, this was another item. He was pointing out that my Kindle Nation Daily link was out of date. Steve had a problem with his blog, and so I did fix that. So the listener who told me about the problem with the comments was Errol from the UK, and he said he tried to put several comments up, but they didn't get through. So I did take care of that. And then I've gotten some comments that came in on email, heard from Linda Hopkins talking to me about the rumors of the Kindle coming in August, which was great. Also, got an interesting email from David Dietrich, D-E-I-T-R-I-C-K. At first, I was just going to jump on it maybe as a tech tip, but it's actually it's fascinating to me because I do have an iPad, and I'm trying out all kinds of content. He's figured out a way to get non-Amazon content onto his iPad, going through the iBooks app on there. And I think what I'm going to do is simply copy and paste this information into the show notes so that if you would like to move some things to your iPad, this is the way to do it. A little bit off topic for the Kindle podcast, but still interesting, and appreciated David sending me that. Rick Askenaze, here from the Boston area, sent me a link to the excellent Wall Street Journal article. I was sort of avoiding reading that one because the headline sort of offended me. It was sort of Vanity Press goes digital or something. But I'm glad Rick sent me the link because it is an excellent article, sort of a who's who of who's playing and doing things in the digital space for books. And so I'll have a link to that article, and that was a good one to check out. I think that's about it for comments. If you'd like to leave a comment, you can do it at the show notes page. That's thekindlechronicles.com. You can also send me an email. The email address is simply podchronicles@gmail.com. If you haven't already, I hope that you'll consider checking out my other podcast, which is thereadingedge.com. My original idea there was to do interviews that were not specifically focused about the Kindle. I just haven't had time to get a lot of interviews up there. I have a frustrating list of people that I want to talk to, so I've just got to figure. I got to get my David Allen Getting Things Done system operating so that I can start dropping in an interview. You know, if I could do it even every other week. I have done some video reviews, and I will probably do one comparing the Sony Reader Pocket Edition with the Kobo sometime in the next couple of weeks. But that's at thereadingedge.com. And we've got a Facebook page. If you go to Facebook and search for The Reading Edge, there's a lively group of people that are following the podcast and leaving comments. Finally, a quick update on eBooks for Troops, the project that I co-founded with Ken Clark. The first two Kindles have now arrived in Afghanistan, and Sergeant Andre Corbin is going to be distributing them to the first two soldiers to receive them in the pilot project. And we've also filed our incorporation papers, and Ken, I think, is going to have the nonprofit application in the mail by Monday. So there's been a lot of activity that's positioning us to really move forward with that project to provide ebook technology to soldiers serving the country overseas. Great project. You can learn more about it at ebooksfortroops.org. Music for my podcast is Ramonk by Eval Monegat on the Variations in Time, a Jazz Perspective CD by Public Transit Recording, courtesy of IODA Promoting. This is Len Edgerly from Cambridge, Massachusetts for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.